Greetings, this was a Patreon exclusive episode from Consensus Unreality made in the year 2022, from their series Saucers of Despair. If you enjoy this episode, consider signing up to patreon.com/consensusunreality for regular exclusive episodes, a printed journal, exclusive written content and more. Enjoy the episode.
Welcome to another edition of Consensus Unreality, a Patreon exclusive.
A Patreon podcast.
Right, totally. It's pretty great that you like you can't hear the tapes that I've been opening.
What did you play?
These episodes with, because they're going from a tape player right into the recorder, obviously not over Zoom. But I feel like that, I was just thinking that could get pretty interesting, actually.
What did you play?
Tonight, I'm currently playing a section of Graham Lampkin's Draining the Vats cassette. This is one of my favorites. But it's funny because, like, I just rewound to a random section of the tape, and it's him, like, just kind of like doing some like echoey like weeping sounds in what seems to be like a damp basement, you know. It's very Saucers of Despair. He's a
boo-hoo.
Yeah, he's like a currently active musician who does a lot of sound poetry, or the poetry of sounds.
He's cool.
Field recordings and stuff. That's why I was asking you earlier if you listened to the Shadow Ring. That's the
band. No, is that, that's his band?
Yeah, it's his band from like the 90s. They're also really interesting. English band. Really like crazy spoken word kind of vocals and awesome lyrics and shit. Kind of dead.
I guess I have to listen.
Deadpan, like outsider music.
Yeah.
So
we're talking about a few different things today.
Oh my god!
I had a revelation, actually. I guess you did too, but not a revelation. But I'm reading this book, The Dark Gods, by Anthony Roberts and Jeff Gilbertson, and it is literally it could have been called Saucers of Despair.
Holy like, shit!
Well, it's kind of like a. I guess I'll talk about it more a little later on, but the gist of it is that UFOs and their occupants are, it's a very post-Kiel, post-Valle, and they cite them a lot, but UFOs and aliens are not good. They're demons, but not like from a Christian perspective necessarily, more like from like a Lovecraft perspective. He like the first chapter is this guy kind of just like,
you know, we love that,
just fawning over H.P. Lovecraft. So it's kind of, but like it's these two guys and they kind of trade chapters back and forth, and it's some really interesting stuff that, and there's like, it's this crazy confluence of this sort of, they don't get into like the specifics of like Kenneth Grant cosmology or anything like that, because I think they were kind of contemporaries, but they do get into a lot of like historical and religious history about like devils and demons and like sort of these weird outsider figures like that come in and sort of mess with human affairs, and they tie it all into this sort of like very classic Illuminati conspiracy theory.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, that actually reminds me, for the next part in this series, we should definitely cover Saucers of the Illuminati. I think was one we talked a little bit about on
Keith.
Yeah, our previous eps. That's a good section of the tape there. Maybe I'll cue that up for the credits. But yeah, so much to talk about. I mean, that book sounds incredible. I actually got to pick that up.
This one's super hard to find. It took me a few years to find a copy, and then I did like 3 years ago, and then I kind of just stuck it on my shelf to read eventually, and then something was like in my mind when we were kind of talking about how to connect all this stuff into ufology. I was like, wait, isn't that book kind of doing that? And then it turns out it is. And yeah, it's good. I mean, it's funny how it's kind of like, it feels like retracing some of the stuff that we looked into over the course of the podcast. It felt very, like a lot of it is very familiar. A whole long section about like occult influences on Nazism and stuff. And a lot of the kind of research we were doing back then with Mike kind of like came back up. But there's this really strange little chapter in here where they're, he's talking about like some person's memoir of like sitting in on an Adolf Hitler speech, and they were describing it as like, he looks like he was channeling, like he looked like he was a medium when he was speaking, like, and that's like very scary. So they're, and like, they're kind of like suggesting that these, you know, so-called dark gods were to some large extent responsible for the rise of like the Nazi party, which, you know, this book's great because it has this Colin Wilson introduction. It's like, these guys are, Colin Wilson is like this kind of incredible combination of skeptic and like mystic. He's basically like, these guys take a lot of stuff for granted and just kind of fly with it. But if you read the book, you'll see that they're probably onto something, and it's a very strange, disturbing book. That's basically like the gist of Colin Wilson's introduction. And that's kind of the way it goes. It's really good.
Damn. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty funny. And like, it, what gods are responsible for, you know, the current trajectory of the United States and the trajectory of the United States for the past
probably the 100
years as well, you know, right? I mean, that's an interesting thing. I think we mentioned in our Secret Destiny of America episode, I probably mentioned that the occult etymology of America comes from Amar Ruka, which means like the land of the plumed serpent. I know that it's accredited to the explorer Amerigo Vespucci, but it's said that it's actually given its name through an occult lineage of meaning the land of the plumed serpent. Mythologically, that's kind of a character I think that is going to be a big part of this show, not specifically the plumed serpent, but kind of parsing out this weird, at least on my end, this weird history of Luciferianism, but also the worship of Saturn and the Gnostic demiurge, kind of revisiting also these abyssal dweller deities like Abraxas, some stuff like that. I've been big into the astrotheology stuff all week. Also, we watched some films to talk about. And I think maybe I was thinking that maybe a cool entry point would actually be to talk about a dark song to begin the episode. Because I think there was, I actually found some parts of that movie to say some interesting things about magic.
Sure.
And the occult.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I mean, well, it's not a great movie, but it's a really good occult movie, which is hard to do.
Yeah, 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 that's totally true, especially in this day and age, with how much of the occult exists on the internet. It's like, it's kind of funny, like the way that we understand the occult, I think, is given to us so much through not just the broader internet, but like also now the language of memes and stuff. That's like where the occult and conspiracy culture and the esoteric is like heavily represented and almost like transmuted in an alchemical sense, you know, like
kind of. I think it's also just trending right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true. It's like kind of in a weird way, like getting back into, it's a root of like creating these visual allegories for hidden knowledge, the way that the like illuminated alchemical texts would hide their knowledge, and we're kind of doing it in this trash way.
And I mean, arguably, that's kind of what I'm like getting at with my research for tonight's episode is kind of that a lot of, you know, the Abrahamic texts and the transgressions that would become Gnosticism, or the sons of light in the Essenes, Mithraism, passed down from Zoroastrianism, is all kind of like part of this astrotheology that stems from the oldest Sumerian religions of like solar worship and stuff. And this isn't like a revolutionary concept. This thing has been talked about. I think Thomas Paine kind of is one of the first big names to make the reference of Christ being like a solar myth, way before, obviously, people have been talking about that in the 20th century. But Thomas Paine, yeah, I think, was like saying that back then. But there is like allegorically a lot of interesting threads there. But I mean, back to A Dark Song, pretty cool movie. I mean, it's to approach the Abramelin working in a film seems pretty Herculean, being that a figure like Aleister Crowley, I guess it's like an esoteric thing enough in itself that it's like, oh well, you know, the magic nerds who are going to be like, you didn't portray that correctly, they're so far and few between that it doesn't really matter. But
yeah, well, I mean, it's probably true. that's like the I feel like they at least consulted the text, which is good.
It's pretty legit. I mean, yeah, like I have to say,
it must be so boring to do it accurately. And it's like that, grimoires and magical things, they're just like, you know, they don't really make sense to do in a modern setting. So I think that they actually handled that. I mean, I haven't seen this movie for like 2 years, but if I remember correctly, they kind of handle the way that it's like this antiquated sort of insane series of actions and like non-actions. It's kind of handled in this weird way.
No, absolutely. I was going to say that it's Crowley, who's the most infamous character arguably of the 20th century, apart, you know, like that wasn't an abomination like Hitler or something, but like infamous like cultural character. And this is his most infamous action, is the Abramelin working that took place on Loch Ness. So it is kind of like this big taboo object of a cult culture, culture, whatever the fuck. But yeah, no, I think that is one thing I noticed within the film, is that they portray the asceticism within these alchemical essentially rituals. You know, I forgot about that part, and as somebody who isn't a practitioner, is kind of just a researcher, you forget that the practice, like the true practice of these like high magic rituals, like something like the Abramelin, is like super super ascetic, labor intensive. What I found interesting is that when the practitioner in the film is expressing the difficulty in nature of this ritual to the other character, who is not super familiar with magic or magical workings, you know, he's saying that like the people who say that this is like exploring, magic is exploring realms of your own consciousness, which is a popular thing in, you know, the occult scene and podcasts and stuff. I mean, that seems to indicate that the filmmakers were at least, you know, in the know to say that, even, I think, because there are a lot of people who, you know, it's a very popular kind of, thing in occult culture right now to say that like magical rituals is just accessing different portions of your own psychology and working through your own human psychology.
Right. That's just like pop, like, you know, like it's kind of bullshitty. It's, you know, like,
yeah. I mean, well, yeah. And it's also like, that's the trope of referring to everything as kind of Jungian, is this like scapegoat.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it also kind of, I think that notion reduces the serious nature of these types of rituals. And I'm not saying that it's like you're going to be damned, because I think that part of the that part of the connotation in the film is more, you know, for a film. But I do think that, like, these rituals and the point of these rituals, even when we talk about, like, somebody like Kenneth Grant and stuff like that, and in the film they refer to these rituals as Gnostic, which I found interesting. Something that I probably would have had more of a point of contention with years ago, but now I'm sort of realizing that the transgressive nature of these rituals, the point of them is to be materially devoured, you know, like crossing that, the abyss, in a sense, of like Crowley is to forego fortune and favor in your own personal life for the prospect of that Enochian ability to see the architecture of the cosmos,
right,
to see, you know, the landscape of Jupiter's reign, in the Greek sense, to unveil, to go behind the curtain of Oz, all that shit. I think to get there, like, there is that sense of obliterating your personal self. And not just like an ego death, but I mean like aesthetically really getting there. And that seems to be represented in the rituals of Catharism as well, which I think is nice about this movie, is you really start to get the grasp of like how serious, how intense these rituals, these magical workings are, and that you don't just induce the altered state of consciousness by taking a substance. Like, you really have to aesthetically get there through like this, the repetition of these processes, through like the ritual cleansing, all of that stuff. Very interesting.
I'm remembering that movie now. I guess it's a lot of like just, you know, grueling kind of like asceticism, I guess, is the right word. I wonder, my sort of thoughts on magic and stuff have changed too. I don't know if it's, I mean, I never thought it was like making changes within your own mind, or like, you know, there's sort of like manifestation thing, although that might be a form of magic, but I tend to think that it's real, and I don't really know. I don't have a firm like metaphysics of why. I'm still kind of figuring that out, but some of my experiences have shown that it doesn't even necessarily have to be intentional. I guess magic would be the act of taking these other forces that happen and sort of bending them to your will, I guess. But it kind of just happens without that as well. And that's been my experience more. And I'm not just talking about coincidences, but sort of like the really strange charged experiences.
Mm. It's weird. I mean, I think I'm realizing now that he's obviously not the progenitor of that frame of thinking, that magic is kind of like a psychology of mind, but I do remember one of the first people exposing me to that idea is Polk Runyon, who I actually really like. But
I like him too.
He treads both sides of the spectrum in talking about magical ritual. He's an interesting guy. He's got a podcast called The Hermetic Hour, which is terrible sound quality, but it's like a very, very informative monologue type podcast.
And of course he did Beyond Lemuria, one of the great films of all time.
I think the point of saying that, like, that the Abramelin is a Gnostic ritual, that I found very, very interesting. And I'll explain why. It's basically because I think I thought that, like, or I kind of envisioned Gnosticism to be in rejection of like what I assumed, you know, what my own connotations of magic and magical ritual and magical workings were. in that they seem to be based more in like a Faustian kind of worldly dealings, you know?
Yeah.
And Gnosticism, you know, I thought maybe when I was younger, I ideally understood it, idealistically understood it to be, this kind of higher road of faith, of like the rejection of the material in terms of like this ecstatic, kind of like monolithic, Godhead. But that's not really true. I mean, and obviously we've talked about Gnosticism being not existing, even that there are just like kind of different transgressive, Judaic, groups, mystery cults. Obviously there's like the groups that aren't Judaic as well, the cult of Mithras coming out of Zoroastrianism into like Roman mystery tradition. You know, we haven't even mentioned the cult of like Dionysus, which plays into this a lot as well.
Yeah.
But all of these transgressions, these going against orthodoxy, they play into magical ritual, and I think there is kind of a lineage there into Crowley's own Gnostic mass, which I kind of usually would assume to be a pretty superficial connection to Gnosticism. But maybe there's more there than I had originally thought, especially when looking at the invocation of like the deity Abraxas in the Gnostic mass,
yeah.
Crowley's Gnostic mass. Abraxas is kind of like this weird like mystery deity of Gnostic thought, and it's kind of like a magical invocation in itself. The word Abraxas being seven letters, seven being that like magical number, so it's like a deity, a word representing like transfiguration, transformation, knowledge, I guess. It also contains like the vowel sounds, the chanting of vowel sounds is like this super big thing. It's even like legitimate, it's literally like in some of the Gnostic texts, like maybe the Gospel of Philip or the Book of the Egyptians, I'm forgetting, one of those Nag Hammadi, a couple of those Nag Hammadi texts actually have like just letter, like vowel letters, like spread out. It's like chanting. So I don't know, I guess not. It seems that Gnosticism and like the Hellenistic groups that we've talked about in the past episode, they really do, they kind of get hammered out by the Roman Church and the, you know, the Holy Roman Empire, and then they kind of go dark and become the alchemical grimoires, and the alchemical illuminated texts. And maybe there is more of a lineage there to Rosicrucianism, to, I mean, Masonry. I think I wanted to talk about Masonry on this show too, because the symbols of Masonry, at least, are very dense, with this kind of like astro theology and esoteric thought, that
sure.
they are the keepers of this like mystery tradition in a way, which is,
they want you to think that they are, at least.
Well, I think that at one point Masonry kind of stood as representing these like transformative rituals and stuff, and now I think that maybe it serves the kind of things that it was working against at one point, you know, like there could,
maybe.
Just, it's been hundreds of years. I mean, it could just be a philosophical change or degradation there.
Sure. I think some things might just genuinely be lost to time, though. I'm a bit more skeptical than I have been in the past about like how much of these sort of mysteries have really been handed down. But then you read something like the Dark Gods book and you kind of wonder if there's not sort of these like non-temporal sort of beings that might be storing this information and imparting it again and again in different forms, mostly to our detriment. they do this really interesting thing. Well, it's not interesting. It sucks, but they quote a lot from this person, Nesta Webster, who is this big proponent of, like, you know, Jewish conspiracy in the 20s. Pretty influential on British sympathies with Nazi Germany, actually. But she was also kind of the person to repopularize the Illuminati conspiracy, like the actual Weishaupt kind of Bavarian Illuminati. And she kind of added into it, and I'm not exactly sure where she got it, but Roberts and Gilbertson kind of take her at face value, although they kind of bolster it with other stuff later. So they're not just running with her, but she's sort of the first one they introduced. Anyway, this idea that the Illuminati, which I think in the sort of current understanding of these conspiracy theories is kind of one and the same with what we think of as Freemasonry in the conspiratorial sense, that they are sort of in communication with these entities and doing the bidding of them. Like, there's always this hidden sort of degree or something, that's hidden master above all the others that was not actually a human being. And that kind of goes back to the paranoia that people had about the Knights Templar communicating with a talking skull, or, you know, a head that had, or something that they called a head that might not have been.
Right. And yeah, if I could interject there, I mean, that's interesting because if you take the word demiurge, in the Platonic sense, it means like a craftsman, an architect, right? Like,
yeah.
And so the Neoplatonists, like we talked about in the last episode, they basically were in confliction with the Gnostics and maybe the Hermeticists, in that they thought, well, how could the demiurge be a bad god, the creator, the craftsman of the universe, if everything exists in this like perfect natural harmony,
right?
This spheres, the aethers, etc. This gets into this idea that the Masons, and it's a weird like kind of like mesh between Gnosticism, Luciferianism, and what I think to be is something a lot of people talk about too, is like a Saturnal worship of Saturn being an analog, or maybe the opposite, the Demiurge being an analog to Saturn.
Sure.
And the Masons, like, obviously they call it the craft, you know, and they refer to themselves as the sons of Cain. Cain, his lineage is that Cain was not born of Adam and Eve. This is like a Christian folk subtext, that Cain was not born from Adam and Eve, but he was born from Eve and Samael, who was like kind of one of the archons, or a fallen angel, depending on which reading of the text you're ascribing it to. So the Masons basically are the builders of Solomon, the Tubal Cain. What's Haram Abiff is like their Christ figure, who was a builder of the temple, who was murdered. His lineage
got bonked on the head, right?
Yeah, his lineage is to Tubal Cain, who has lineage to the biblical Cain. So, I mean, there's this kind of sense that if the Masons are in contact with entities, then they would be archons. They would be the keepers of the material world and doing the bidding of the Demiurge, which in this Gnostic cosmology, this Gnostic war of the cosmos, means that they are existing in ignorance, serving like the keeper of a false world, and not serving the true God. Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that the way that this mythology plays out, when it's projected onto the world in a conspiratorial sense. Because, I mean, people, like, there's like layers to it too, where people will be like, the Masons worship the devil. And it's like, well, it's not really true. If anything, they're worshiping Saturn, because Saturn is like the god of the world, the king of the world, the keeper of, you know, the time in the cosmos.
Is he such a complex god?
Well, I mean, that's what it is mythologically, you know, and Jupiter becomes that when they banish Saturn. But Saturn is the progenitor of the cosmos.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it all bleeds out.
And this is this is like represented in Gnosticism. The Demiurge is Yaldabaoth, who is the lion-headed serpent. That goes back to the Amaru, the plumed serpent. But also,
it also has influence from Mitra too, right? Zoroastrian, which I found interesting because
the Leontocephaline, which I realized, and this is like kind of one of the revelations I made in this research. That's a really interesting connection. If you look at the Leontocephaline, who was a creation of Mithras, it's this lion-headed, winged deity who his legs are wrapped in serpents. It's very, very, it's pretty close to the Yaldabaoth. Obviously there's some like crossover there, but he was the keeper of Mithras' great scepter of immortality. They were both dwellers on the threshold of reality. So in this way, they're relative to Saturn, as they're the keepers of the cosmos. They're the keepers of time and the material world. They're both these chimeric lion-headed serpentine figures.
Saturn? Well, Saturn isn't. Saturn's a guy.
Yeah, no, Leontocephaline. Yeah.
So I guess a lot of this comes out of the Sethianism, right? And then Sethianism has this pretty close-ish relationship with Mandaeism, which had some really strange stuff in it about, let me see if I can find it, about the worship of especially John the Baptist, which has been one of my little areas of looking into over the last week.
The prevalence of like the goat imagery is representative of Saturn.
The goat and what's like the bottom of Capricorn, the fish and the goat, I guess.
Right.
The crossing the year, I guess. Was it a year back then? Why is Capricorn the dual aspect thing? Something about the abyss, maybe?
It's when it was always representative of the new year because it's the abyss, but it's also the, it's, you know, when the sun is at its darkest point, its weakest.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The John the Baptist stuff is so interesting because in some ways it almost feels like he was like, I mean, for the Mandaeans, I guess they were, he sort of was the main, like the major and final prophet of whatever, you know, thread of religion that was. And so like when Jesus sort of came along to usurp John, it's kind of like, it all feels like it has to do with that milieu of like the sort of the re-version of Mithras as Jesus sort of usurping this John character. A lot of this, it feels like they're, you can just like look at these sort of like competing cults and see almost like a sort of sense of like politics happening or something.
There's also this deity of Aeon in the Greek Hellenistic Aeon, A-I-O-N, which is funny because in Gnosticism Aeons are obviously this very prominent portion of their cosmology, but Aeon, the deity in Greek, I think is the son, is like the child of Serapis. Serapis is this weird mystery religion, kind of like Mithraism, where it's also one of those like proto Christ, dying God mystery cults. Anyway, Aeon is also like the keeper of the wheel of time, of eternity, and the keeper of the zodiac. I mean, this in this way, it's like Mithras as well, where Mithra was the keeper of the 12-point zodiac. a funny thing about Aeon is that the celebration of Aeon is on January 6th is the festival of Aeon. Pretty funny sync there. But yeah, the symbol of the hoop, the wheel, the Ouroboros.
There's a lot about good old Parsifal in this Dark Gods book.
Mm.
And the sort of... I've been having a lot of really strange experiences lately. And a lot of them revolve around reading something that I had sort of already been doing or had already been thinking about, and then it sort of comes up.
That's really...
And that came up with this, you know, like in the Parsifal myth, the lance that heals, like in one version of the Parsifal myth, it's what eventually is able to heal the unhealing wound is this lance that he kind of stabs him with.
Right.
I've sort of finally gotten back into writing this next chapter, kind of, not chapter, but this next iteration of a work. And sort of one of the main conceits in it is this character is trying to get these two god figures to charm this knife that he owns to make it so that when it stabs, it heals. But I didn't know where that came from. And then like a day later, I read this, which I guess must have been in the back of my mind, but not to the extent that I would have used it. I thought I was making it up.
Mm.
Just very strange stuff like that.
Visit patreon.com/consensusunreality. Visit patreon.com/consensusunreality. Visit patreon.com/consensusunreality. Visit patreon.com/consensusunreality.
Visit patreon.com/consensusunreality.
Occult philosophy is like, it's people trying to get at the heart of like the nature of reality, you know, like trying to what we talked about, like seeing behind the curtain, peeling back the curtain of the cosmos, right. You know, and for a lot of people, that kind of power doesn't even make it past their own ego, their own sense of the world, their own physiological place in the world, you know?
I think that makes sense. Yeah. It's so strange. Yeah. You watched The Caller.
I did. I watched The Caller.
The only truly Gnostic film.
Yeah. 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 That really is actually pretty Gnostic, I guess.
I think it is.
Yeah.
And there's only two people, and I guess we shouldn't ruin it.
Yeah. We're not going to ruin it. But I'm going to ruin it. No.
You can ruin it.
Actually, now that I think about it, the Dark City they must have seen that movie, The Writers of Dark City.
Oh yeah.
You know when there's like you see a film and it's you instantly know it's got to be connected to another film, like Dark City is actually kind of like that in a sense, especially in the plot of Dark City. And
oh, because it's a kind of a noir kind of like genre exercise that then becomes a sort of Gnostic parable.
Right.
It's kind of like a Baroque version of The Caller, I guess.
Yeah. Also better, but
yeah, much better. But I like The Caller.
And no, it's cool.
If you want to listen to, if you don't want to listen to us spoiling it, maybe skip ahead by 2 minutes.
Well, I don't know. We don't have to talk about the end of the, oh, well, I guess I did just spoil.
Well, what are they?
Oops. I don't know. I'll have to fix this part of the episode.
It doesn't matter. I'm not really that beholden to spoiler stuff. Nobody's gonna understand anyway.
Maybe I'll put a note in the do I ever even do this? I don't know. If you're listening, I swear I'll try and put a time signature in there, in the notes of the episode. Yeah, I don't know, man. I guess it is supremely Gnostic in that way, and that's why it reminds me of Dark City, because Dark City, it makes you think that it's like kind of this prototypical like 90s rainy New York murder movie, and then it reveals itself to be like this mechanical Gnostic matrix, you know?
A matrix, yeah. I like when they What's that like? They have like the beach thing. It's like go to the beach or whatever, like that sign.
Yeah, it's dude. Dark City is really, really good. Actually, I might rewatch that scene.
Yeah,
I would say like it appeals more to me. I was 1 second away from being like, dude, it's better than The Matrix, but The Matrix is fucking sick. I mean, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, you know? I like it more than The Matrix.
It's like it appeals to me more. It's way more of like it achieves the Gnostic imagery and philosophy in a way more effective way. But The Matrix is just fucking, it's a slammer, you know, it's like mad entertaining film.
And The Caller, the best of the three, it has Malcolm McDowell.
Right. Yeah, that was pretty sick.
I like him.
Yeah, he's great.
He just shows up once in a while and is a psychopath.
Yeah.
Or, and, you know.
It was like an interesting, like frustrating movie because it's so, it's so like film school-y in the way that it like, not film school-y, but like producers. You could tell that was, it almost seems like that was made by a group of like dudes who worked on other TV shows and movies. And they were like, we're going to make our own thing. We're going to do it. It seems like it was made by like a cameraman or something. And that it was like shots, you know, these like panning suspenseful shots, and the dialogue, is kind of this like frustrating ebb and flow that culminates into this like La Reveal.
It feels like a play kind of too. Yeah. Well, just, if you just have two characters, there's only so much you can do.
That's what I texted Ben in the middle of watching this. And I was like, is this based on a Zoo Story?
Yeah.
You know what a Zoo Story is?
No.
It's like this famous play from,
oh, I do know what that is. Yeah.
The 60s. It's about two dudes on like a park bench in Central Park. And it's pretty good. I actually have it on like LP. And the dude, one of the dudes in it is like the principal from fucking Boy Meets World. He's like the stage actor in it. Mr. Feeny.
Mr. Feeny.
But yeah, it reminded me a lot of that in that it's like these two dudes and this conversation is like on an arc towards like this reveal where it's like, I killed somebody today and fucking blah, blah, blah. New York is so dangerous. I killed him. But,
a Zoo Story.
Yeah, no, it was cool. That was a good one.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
I watched, thank you for that recommendation, listener. Who was that?
That was Corey.
Yeah. That was good. I mean, deep cut too. I've never even heard of that. So
no, I hadn't either. What was the other one?
Oh, you know what was cool about? I think the soundtrack was pretty sick to The Caller.
And The Caller was pretty cool. Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it had that. I remember now. It had the hydrophone, which is a funny like sound man like effect in like horror movies and shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very like tropey, and I like that. I like that it was like playing on tropes and stuff. I watched Allison's Birthday on your recommendation, which was really good. An Australian film, maybe Baz knows about that one.
Is it what is the, they worship that goddess, right? I can't remember the name.
Oh shit.
It's like an ancient Celtic god, isn't it?
Yeah. The Celtic cult like gets chased out and then they like settle in the outback, I think.
Right. Yeah. It's really good.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's very Rosemary's Baby-ish. Like.
Right. Yeah. But I liked it. That has a great soundtrack too. Like the wacky synth shit.
And the like Ouija scene at the beginning.
Ah, excellent.
Is one of the best I've seen. There's been some pretty bad Ouija scenes and that's not one of them.
Right. Yeah. Also, in A Dark Song, like, I have to say the production style was incredible because, like, up until maybe a certain point that it is a little contentious, which I won't talk about at the end of the film. If you want to watch that one, I'll leave that surprise open for you. But, when they portray, let's say, mystical beings or something, for the most part, they're done pretty well, and it's, like, almost... Yeah. Yeah, like stage theater production level. I thought that movie was cool. It had a really great score. the ending of that movie is kind of interesting. Goes the way of almost like Christianized, you know, a Christianized redemption.
Yeah.
Type thing.
I mean, all this magic is really Christian when you get down to the bones of it. I mean, except for Kabbalah, which has also been Christianized, but like the whole Western magic thing is, you know, pretty inextricable from thousands of years of Christian rule.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's indebted to the theology of Christianity and the mythology, but at the same time, like that mythology is indebted to, as I mentioned before, like Sumerian, especially Egyptian, astro theology. And I think that's still at the heart of this. I mean, when you look at it, like all of these symbols, you'll often see portrayed the apostles, I mean, the four gospels being portrayed by a lion, an eagle, an ox, and a man. You have the four constants, the equinoxes of the zodiac represented there. You have the lion in the Leo. You have the eagle, which is a dual sign with the Scorpio, also sometimes represented by the serpent. So you have the lion, the eagle. You have the man, which is Aquarius. And you have the ox, which is Taurus. So you have fall, spring, winter, summer.
I think of those four, I'd obviously want to be the man.
Yeah. And I mean, there's also like the lion. The lion is its representation with Yaldabaoth and the Leoncephalion. Those things being lion-headed gods, the representation there is that the lion represents the apex of the zodiac in that the sun is at its brightest and most illuminated in Leo. It's the high point of the zodiac. It's not the end of the year, but it's the high point. And that's why, like, Jesus is sometimes represented by a lion, especially in, like, C.S. Lewis, in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The lion is, like, the Christ figure.
Oh, yeah. Weird. I wanted to mention C.S. Lewis because they're, like, really weirdly gung-ho about his space trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Paralandria, or whatever it said. Like, those three sci-fi books where it's this kind of Gnostic allegory, I guess. I always thought C.S. Lewis was always, like, a devout Christian, and he kind of started that way, but I guess he kind of developed into like this sort of mystic Christian over the course of his career.
Right, right.
And kind of tried on some other things.
That's pretty sick. I would check out some of that stuff.
I'm going to listen to that on audiobook next, the Space Trilogy, because it sounds like kind of like a Gnostic, you know, like the Manichaean kind of dualistic cosmology kind of thing. It's like with these sort of warring angels. So they use it as kind of like, they're saying like H.P. Lovecraft, C.S. Lewis knew of the existence of these dark gods. You know, this book is really crazy. It was shocking the extent to which it felt like the obvious answer to like, when you pose like the idea of like saucers of despair, it's in a kind of joking like Morris K. Jessup sort of redux kind of way, but then we kind of just randomly decided to start talking about like Gnosticism, and not randomly, but you know, like divertedly.
Yeah,
I was like, how can, and you know, how can those two things connect? And we kind of found some minor ways of doing that, but this book kind of feels like there's no super explicit Gnostic stuff. There's mentions of it, of course, but like, yeah, it's very much about archons. I mean, like, that's like kind of exactly what they're describing.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe I have some stuff that can really get home with that connection for the next edition, and I'll save that because we could really expand on that, and it'll also connect to some other stuff that we've talked about on the show. But the idea of like conjuration and technology, and the communication with entities. I think that kind of, obviously it's a relationship to the Lovecraftian thing that we see in so many of these like Kenneth Grant related groups, and the Michael Berto group and the Gnostic Wudan stuff and NEMA and the Beit Cabal, all that stuff has its relationship to what we're talking about. And I think maybe we could revisit some of that stuff in a different way, connecting to some other things that I'm not mentioning. But I do think it's interesting that with that lion symbolism, you also have like the killing of the lion represents passing through the 12 houses of the zodiac. And this is something that Gilgamesh, Hercules, and Samson of the Bible all kill a lion as one of their feats. And that's like kind of like breaking the 12 houses of the zodiac, breaking through the wheel of the zodiac.
Right. Do the labors of Hercules have a sort of calendaristic aspect to them?
They must. And I haven't, that's the extent to which I've kind of looked at that specifically. But there has to be way more astrotheology in there, because the Greeks were, it was all sky gods, and that the Hellenistic Greek thought, it's like it permeates through all of this shit. And it really the Hellenistic era does seem to be responsible for so much of our modern mythology, and the way that you know, the true ancient religions were passed down to us through the Hellenistic era through their interpretations.
There is one other thing when we're talking about Freemasonry. It got me thinking about, so Keel and Vallée and people like that are often talking about how the UFO is an alien, you know, and alien encounters are like a modern technological manifestation of something that's happened to humans forever. That's kind of, you know, it's almost cliche on this podcast at this point, but, and that's what they talk about in the Dark Gods. But do you think like stuff like Freemasonry are these kind of like, is there like a technological, if the technology of Freemasonry was, you know, geometry and architecture and stonework, are the like elite of today still using those as metaphors, or might the technology of today like have its own sort of Freemasonic aspect? Like, it makes me think of some sort of cult with like Silicon Valley type sort of, do you know what I'm saying? Like, sort of like,
I do.
If the UFO myth evolved from like fairy lore, is there some sort of parallel sort of cult that evolved from Freemasonry into our own technological age?
And not to be disappointing, but I don't think it's like as explicit as there's a cult. I think the extent of what you're talking about, like a techno cult, would be Esalon out there. And the way that at the Esalon, I know, but that's like disappointing, but it's true. The way that the Esalon Institute has influenced like
that's true.
So much like thought within the tech community out on the West Coast.
You could say the same of like SRI though, or like any given university.
Yeah, but Esalon is pretty like new agey and shit. And it's like it's
that's true.
It's an intersection of like spirituality and like technology.
Right.
In like West Coast like university like philosophical way.
I'm saying more like an actual sort of...
Damn, I'm not proud of myself for the combination of words I just put there. I wish I had a better way of describing that.
No, I see what you're saying. I kind of mean like a more direct descendant of Freemasonry that like takes those principles and metaphors mainly and sort of applies it to the technology today. Like
I think it's all the same. I mean, I think that you can look like... You can look at... like our technological developments and what we're doing with CERN and stuff on an objective fundamental level, like you can see that as being completely relative to everything Masonry has been talking about for hundreds of years and what these mystery cults have been talking about for hundreds of years. I mean, what we're doing is that it is essentially killing the lion, like smashing the particle is killing the lion. You know, that is, that's like the alchemical goal, right? We talked about that this on a different episode, is that the objectives of CERN relate to that idea of being able to draw down the heavens and create matter itself, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And that Saturnal like thing of being able to transmute the elements and create things out of nothing is kind of like a magical objective in some instances. And
this is all reminding me of a novel I read one time. It's pretty weird. I think, I mean, basically you're saying that like myths are myths because they are going to be applicable throughout time.
I don't know. I mean, I think that they're, maybe that's why. I mean, that's a very Joseph Campbell way of looking at it.
I think it's
it.
Just, or I guess Jung, or just any, most understandings of myth, I guess.
But I think there's an undeniable other. And I think that's what's interesting when you look at somebody like Michael Berto, is what I was kind of talking about in the last episode too, in his work, is that when you listen to him talk, it doesn't really seem to describe anything. And that's kind of like a lot of occultists who aren't like blessed with having like a visually descriptive vocabulary. But I mean, maybe that's not the point, is that all of this stuff is about practice. It's about experience. And it's about seeing these things for yourself. It's about going behind the curtain for yourself and not really reading somebody else's description of it, because that's an interpretation. I mean, these things are experiential. I mean, that's what makes Gnosticism so appealing to me in the first place, is that Gnosticism dismisses all of that. Gnosticism dismisses the cosmos themselves. You know, like Gnosticism says that there is something purer than all of that, than everything. You know, like there is no, it seems to say at some point, like there is no point in like the procession through the cosmos. But I guess the point of that is to break free of them.
Right. Right. Yeah. To get out into beyond the beyond.
Beyond the firmament into the pleroma. Yeah.
I've been reading, on that note, a lot about, in this new thing I'm writing, I've been reading a lot about boundary markers and the weird, both like in the quotidian sense of like land surveying, but also in like the weird aspects of it, like Herms, and I guess Herme would be the plural of, you know, these sort of like block statues with the head of Hermes at the top that would sort of denote property bounds and other sort of important markers, and the Greek equivalent, or no, that was Greek already. So I guess a Herm is sort of a subcategory of Horoi, just like all these like sort of strange magical statues. And then in Rome, they had a god actually who was the god of boundary markers. Terminus was that god. And even in Zoroastrianism, the god Mitra was a god of boundaries. Mm. So like all these sorts of little threads come together.
Yeah, that
weird thing.
That makes sense with Mithras as well. And that connection there is that Mithras is kind of this boundary marker of the wheel of time. And like the secrets maybe of passing through the 12 houses of the zodiac and beyond the material world and its time and space.
Yeah. there's all these, like, aside from the mythological stuff, just these sort of folk traditions about where just this whole concept of property has been really interesting to me lately, because it's kind of, well, it's become insane in modern society, for one thing, but the ways that people used to denote where one begins and another ends, and the way that that's sort of almost like up to the power of some sort of supernatural or God is fascinating. The stones that people put in, or wells, like, yeah, it's fun. It's fun stuff.
That's an interesting thing to be getting into at this time, though, because I think we keep focusing on these boundary dwelling deities in Abraxas, the goat, and what's the other one? Coronzone, obviously, right, in relation to Kronos and Saturn. An interesting thing was Seth, too, in the group. I guess maybe this is kind of one of the last tangents we'll go on here at the end, but like in reading about the cult of Seth and that Gnostic group, who have like distinctly different Gnostic views and points of contention than the Valentinians or the Basileidians, in the group of Seth, who claim lineage to the third son of Adam and Eve, who's kind of like the perfected one, and represents like the child of the highest order, because the other two sons kind of have these faulty qualities. Seth is said to be the creator of astrology and astronomy, because Adam had Seth when he was like 135 years old, and passed down the lineage of these secrets of God, sciences of God. So there's kind of this like interesting Hermes quality there. And there's also like a weird relationship to Set of, you know, Egyptian religion, who kind of becomes Satan, I guess, conventionally accepted, but also in the Kenneth Grant sense and in the mystery religions is more closer related to Lucifer, who is, seems to be a pretty different, different concept than Satan. Lucifer is this light bringer, like relative to the serpent in the Garden of Eden, giving us knowledge of both good and evil, knowledge of God. So that, yeah, there's this relationship with Sethian to the serpent. I don't know. I just kind of find that that little grouping there to be pretty fascinating, considered what we've talked about with Set and the importance of Set in the writings of Kenneth Grant. And, you know, Kenneth Grant claiming that Set is kind of the hidden god represented in the writings of Aleister Crowley. Set, Typhon, this kind of like transgressive deity, and
right,
like working up the dark side of the tree of life as a transgression.
A dark side.
Also, another thing that was pretty good about A Dark Song is the kind of like sadomasochistic qualities of the ritual. That seemed to represent like things that were maybe not related to the Abramelin, but that what these writers had read about Crowley himself and other workings.
Right.
Is it what's represented in the movie is kind of a combat. It's more indicative of the Coronzon working than it is the Abramelin, because I think the Abramelin is performed alone.
And it's also just like a lot of the Abramelin text, at least like the original. I mean, because the one that was going around for a while was the McGregor Mather's Golden Dawn translation, which obviously had its own like axe to grind. But I think when they retranslated it more recently, it's kind of like a lot of it's just like about almost like Talmudic like ways of living in order to be able to do this kind of magic. It's almost like
That's really interesting.
Like, well, because it's, you know, it was Abraham of Ver's burgers. I don't know. Just like some Jewish Kabbalist.
Right.
And so a lot of it's like more like, and I think you see this in other grimoires as well. Sometimes they're just like guidelines for like the type of person who's able to do something, as opposed to like things you read out loud and then a magic circle appears in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's that like, so much of it seems to come from like Jewish mysticism too. Especially the vocalization of words, and all, a lot of this stuff is, you know, about reading Hebrew characters and stuff, right, as well. Kabbalah is like the representation of the word, like the spoken word in the, in Genesis or the Old Testament, the Torah.
The Torah. Pentateuch.
Yeah. I don't know, it's pretty interesting. And I mean, that, that seems to have some other indication that there's a whole plethora of like Middle Eastern ancient mysteries represented within that, you know, and that it's not just like a monotheistic religion, that there's like,
right.
Yeah.
Do you think I should convert to Islam?
I don't know. We should put that up as a poll. Can we do a poll on Patreon?
Probably.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, the new Hellraiser came out.
I didn't watch it yet. I didn't watch it.
No, I won't spoil it, but it blows ass.
I mean, what's there to spoil? You know, like I've seen most of the originals.
It's not a remake. It's kind of like we're gonna take your. I mean, I'm sure they paid him handsomely, but. Wait, is he still alive?
I think he is still alive, yeah.
I would have known if he died.
Oh, dude, you know what's really funny? I saw they were playing Halloween, the original Halloween, in theater. And I went out to see that. And something I never noticed. Actually, Halloween is probably a movie I've seen more than any other movie at this point. Because it's actually like my mother's like favorite Halloween movie. She's really into like scary movies, and that one we would watch like every year almost.
It's good.
It's I think it's one of the best. And it's cool because, you know, Michael Myers originally doesn't really have any mythology. It's basically just like the representation of a boundless evil that like it exists in spite of all conventions of society. You know, of sanity, like this just like inexplicable evil, like just exists, without any background story or mythology. But there's this great scene actually, and there's a weird connection here, total Saucers of Despair territory. Where Dr. Loomis is like getting the sheriff to stay on watch because the sheriff is getting weary, and he's giving him this like speech. You know, it's getting late, and he's like, "Why are we out here? Like, this is ridiculous." And he's like giving him this speech about how Michael Myers is just like 100% evil with like lifeless eyes, and he's like, "All right, I'll stay out here for a couple more hours," and then it immediately cuts back to the kid. In the house who's being babysat, and he's watching the original thing, but it cuts back right back to the TV from there after he says like ultimate evil or something. And the scene on the TV is just a UFO landing in the thing. And I found that really, really, really weird and interesting, because I was like trying to look at Halloween in this new perspective, and I was reading about it before the movie just because I'd seen it so many times that I know everything that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So I was kind of reading about like some people, you know, doing their crits on the film or whatever, and like the kind of philosophy of the character of Michael Myers, or I guess the simplicity of the philosophy of that, and that, and then noticing that, like, that the saucer is there right after that.
Yeah.
Like, is that kind of random, or
that's weird?
At the same time, I guess like the Michael Myers exists as this kind of like, in the film as a character, is like the hyper object of evil, as this like totem, not really like a hyper object, I guess, but like a totem of evil that everybody projects everything onto, because the blankness of the face.
Right.
And the saucer is kind of I don't know. It's the new religious totem in that way, like a techno-religious totem that we've talked about in the Jungian sense, that is like a blank canvas that can be projected onto in that way.
That is weird.
It's just really weird that he did that. I mean, I think it has to be intentional because it's like, it's so in your face once you notice it. And it's, I've never noticed it my entire life. Watching this movie like 20 times, I never really made that connection. But then it's like, boom, it's right there. Pretty interesting.
Evil UFOs. Yeah. The evil flying saucer. Yeah, I wonder. Yeah, that's a weird, weird choice. The next thing I'm looking at lately is Secret Doors of the Earth by Jacques Bergier.
Oh, dude, that looks cool.
Which is, you know, he did, Morning of the Magicians with that other guy.
Oh, right, yeah. I got through a lot of Morning of the Magicians. It's kind of boring, but...
Yeah, that's a crazy book.
I think maybe because it just, like, talks so much about, like, inventors and stuff.
Yeah. That, this one is... Among the possibilities he puts forth in this astonishing new book, there may be secret doors of the earth, phenomenal passageways to other worlds within the visible earth. Extraordinary beings among us who are as old as the planet have formed secret societies to safeguard and propagate a body of knowledge known only to themselves.
Wow.
Etc.
That it's funny that you're going to talk about that book on the next episode, because what I'm thinking about talking about and revisiting is the whole Vril thing and that stuff in connection to this.
Look back into that too.
Yeah. I'm curious now again, kind of to go at it from a different angle. Because that's like the ultimate, that's the apex point of conjuring forces, dark forces seemingly. Right. And
probably,
and gaining knowledge of technology, UFOs.
Right.
That is it. That's Saucer's Despair 101.
I've also been, whenever I'm like writing a new thing, I'll kind of just gather materials for a while. So I kind of just, and then see where it all falls. And I've also been getting back into like Antarctic exploration and like accounts of that. So that's kind of a strange coincidence as well.
And the thing is about, the guys in the Antarctic base. Damn, man. Things are really syncing up.
Plus mudras. You know about mudras, which are the ritual hand gestures of Buddhists and some like, and I guess Shiva priests.
Mm.
It's like, I'm really interested in this idea, and this guy, I don't remember who it is. It's one of the huge like occult scholars, just put out a book called Kinesic Magic, which is about the ritual power of like gesture and posture.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really interested in this, like hand gestures as magical, tools, which I guess was very popular with the Buddhists.
Very popular also, with some other people too.
Who?
The Masons, the Mithraic.
Right.
As well.
Yeah, like so hand gestures as like spells and as like protective. This whole boundary marker thing brought up this idea of apotropaic magic. Apotropaic magic. Whatever. I'm not good at Greek words, which is just the magic of warding off with objects or gestures. So like crossing your fingers or knocking on wood or wearing certain things or, you know, the evil eye is all aspects of this, as well as boundary markers, like having a god on your boundary marker, or even like, you know, sometimes people will put owls, like fake owls outside to like ward off seagulls, even though it's like a, like even though that's real because the seagulls are afraid of owls, it's still kind of like the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, like, before we recorded the episode, I think it went really well, actually. We talked about a lot of different interesting stuff, but I was just thinking what Saucers of Despair means to me again, and I was like, the despair of this kind of research of, like, pulling everything apart so much, you know, and like pulling apart the mythology into these tiny strands, and you'll never really be able to envision what these, like, disparate mystery cults are like, what a window into their world was. I'm so curious, you know, but that quest for knowledge, it just kind of ends in a scary nothingness. That's like the weird Nietzschean thing, right? Is like at the end of his at the end of his life, when he had his nervous breakdown, he was in the square, and his last words before he went catatonic were, "Mother, I'm dumb."
Poor guy. Me too.
I know. Saucers, I mean, of Despair.
That's how it goes. You can't really. At least in the mysteries, it's like they're mysteries for a reason, I guess.
Yeah. What do we do after this series? We just got to go through a wormhole or some shit. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm still pretty spooked on the occult myself. Although, like, back into reading about it and stuff, any sort of practice myself, I'm a little safeguarded with still.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I've opened myself back up to it for a variety of reasons, but not the kind of stuff that got us into trouble. So more like, personal stuff.
Yeah.
It's easier.
Life stuff.
Huh.
Oh, I was watching the original Creature from the Black Lagoon last night. I think I'll probably finish that up tonight. Some really cool underwater scenes and stuff.
The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah,
that's a good one. I've been trying to watch Humanoids from the Deep or whatever, and I keep saying I'm going to watch it, and then it's just sitting there. I can't find it streaming, so it's like I have the DVD, and that one extra step keeps me from doing it.
That's pretty funny.
So if you're listening to this, I recommend finding a copy of The Dark Gods by Roberts and Gilbertson. It's a flawed, but for the purposes of this podcast, extremely useful book to have as a reference. I'll bet there's a PDF floating around, because it's kind of like one of those obscure texts that's kind of famous within its own circle. So I bet somebody scanned it at some point.
Okay, I guess let's sign off.
Yeah.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll be back with another one before Halloween. You know, jump in the comments as always. Let us know what you're thinking. Let us know if you enjoyed this. Also, your recommendations for both movies, books, topics. Books is a little harder because, you know, you got to read a whole book, but definitely take a look at it for sure. Links to weird videos on YouTube.